Remember in 1976, the bicentennial, when we all celebrated the bisons, those buffaloes?
That's right. This is the 200. It's our bicentennial. Welcome to the Gala 200th episode of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And congratulations, Ron.
Congratulations to you, Ken.
Thank you very much.
Our bicentennial. Well, there's a lot to talk about in the political world as well. Obviously, there is a spreading stain across the Gulf of Mexico. It could make its way around Florida. It could come up the East Coast. But no matter how far it actually gets in the loop current, it has already reached Washington.
The president is having a press conference on his a day before he goes down to Louisiana to check out what's happened to his presidency. Some people are saying this is his Katrina. I think that's a little bit overstated, because I think from day one, the administration has made it clear that they have been doing everything they can about the oil spill, which is now the largest in history. But is it enough? And that's what everybody wants to know.
These are fundamentally different challenges, different kinds of catastrophes. In the case of Katrina, you had not only a natural catastrophe, but you also had the failure of the levees, and then you had all these people who were being kept in the Superdome there, and a lot of human suffering.
And also a hesitation by all walks of government. The President
Local
Bush,
state.
Governor Blanco, Mayor Nagin, all were responsible.
And they all had this kind of sense of being so stunned they didn't really know how to react. But you had tens of thousands of people who were in desperate straits.
Right.
You had a great loss of life. And in the case of this, while 11 of the men who worked on the rig were killed in the initial blast, since then we're talking about an environmental disaster, we're talking about an economic disaster, we're talking about something that could go on for years.
People's livelihood, right.
Lose their livelihood. But the sense of the urgency of it, the sense of the 24/7 televised coverage of people out on the roofs of their houses, it's a little bit different from that.
It also, I think, has made most people in the United States suddenly environmentalists. And I think it's kind of an issue that has always been out there for years. I mean, Al Gore, you know, talked about it for many, many years. And Earth Day, 1970, for goodness sakes. And yet, somehow, this issue seems to have taken hold and could be a political issue as well.
Absolutely. Well, we've seen a few oil-slicked birds and some dead dolphins and so forth. But if this goes on indefinitely, it obviously could be a huge boost, in a sense, for those who wish to put the environmental agenda more front and center on the national agenda. At the same time, you look at the polls, and thus far, at least, and of course, we're in early days, perhaps, but thus far, people still care more about the supply of oil, about energy independence, about the price of a gallon of gasoline, than they do about what's going on down in the Gulf, even now in the midst of catastrophe.
Well, perhaps yes, but at the same time, the drill, baby, drill chorus seems to have been muted. I think even President Obama, who gave into that drill, baby, drill argument in order to get more Republican votes for his energy package, that seems to have gone out the window as well.
But I don't know that this changes the fundamental politics of oil and our dependence on the individual automobile and the way that all of our energy and environmental balance has been struck over the last many generations. At least not yet, at least not fundamentally, out of even this great a catastrophe.
Not only does President Obama have the oil spill to deal with, he also had Republicans this week at Tuesday's luncheon.
That's right. He went to the regular Tuesday luncheon the Republicans have.
Senators.
You know, the Democrats have a different room where they go to have lunch. And he, you know, he went into the, if you will, the lion's den, and he wanted to talk about the oil spill, and he wanted to talk about drilling, and he wanted to talk about one big other issue, which was immigration.
Immigration, right.
And he said, essentially, can't get anything done on these without some help from you guys. What's it going to take?
First of all, there are two ways of looking at it. Their Democratic way of looking at it is that the Republicans have shown no indication that they want to help facilitate the Obama agenda at all. The Republican point of view is that what President Obama did on Tuesday was using Republicans as props to show that he really is a bipartisan kind of guy. He really does want to talk across the aisle. But like Bob Corker, who one of the few Republicans who seemed to indicate that he wanted that cross-pollinization of conversation, he said, look, you know, you'll say one thing, but the political establishment and the Democrats on Capitol Hill will say something else, and it's just nonsense.
And Corker comes from Tennessee, and Corker was one of the very few Republicans who won a tight race in 2006, and he has been a potential bridge on energy and on some other
financial
issues,
regulation.
Financial regulation, and he really cares about getting something done and having the government not be totally paralyzed. But it seems as though there's a commitment to a kind of paralysis strategy on the part of the Republican leadership, the Mitch McConnells and so forth, that they don't see any percentage in a compromise on immigration. They don't see any percentage in a compromise was on climate change. And they did everything they could to stop financial regs and health care because they saw no percentage for Republicans in letting any version of those bills pass.
But when you see a Senate caucus, when you hear a Bob Corker or a Susan Collins who also criticized the president, when you lose the Corkers and the Collins of the world, then you know that, look, not that it may have been Republican cooperation anyway down the line, especially in an election year, and I guess every year now is an election year, but I think losing them was disheartening for the White House.
So what should the president do to try to solicit some Republican cooperation so they could go forward on either climate change, energy, or immigration?
I know. I'll send 1,200 troops to the Mexican border.
Well, that
that's exactly what came out of that meeting.
That's a kind of outreach, too, is it not? I mean, to say we have to show some kind of respect for the priorities of the other side. If the Republicans want more border enforcement, let's give them
Democrats
some.
Democrats do want, too. Gabrielle Giffords, the Democratic congresswoman from Arizona, has been calling for more troops. Bill Richardson, the Democratic governor of New Mexico, has been calling for more troops to the border as well. But as John McCain said after the meeting on Tuesday, that 1,200 is just paltry. We need at least 6,000 troops.
Which was coincidentally just the number that George W. Bush sent back in 2006 in his midterm election year. How much good did that do? I mean, as I recall, the flow was very heavy in those years because the American economy was functioning at something like 4.5% unemployment at that point. And the attraction of jobs that were available in the United States was just overwhelming. And so the immigrant flow continued to increase no matter what we did along the border.
Well,
that includes building fence.
The difference between 2006 and 2010 is that Arizona has passed this law that some people have said is just, you know, draconian. Others have said it's absolutely what they've needed all along because Washington was just doing nothing about it. And so perhaps either President Obama was trying to get Republican votes for immigration package or bowing to the reality that his administration or the administration had done nothing on immigration. And this was a first step. But just as he agreed to start drilling for oil to get Republican votes for energy, we wonder if sending troops to the border is enough to get Republican votes for immigration.
Well, and apparently it's not. I mean, not. The one senator you think might have on some level at some point in his career have been sympathetic to a balanced approach, John McCain, immediately went on the floor of the Senate and denounced it. As you say, he said it should be five times larger and we should be devoting ourselves to finishing the fence and so on.
Well, yeah, John McCain is not criticizing President Obama. He's running against somebody even more important, and that was John McCain of 2000. That's who the McCain of 2010 is running against.
That's right. He has to be careful. Now he's running against not only himself of 2000, but also against J.D. Hayworth of 2010, his challenger in the August primary in Arizona.
And the danged amnesty.
Yeah. Well, one other thing is different, though, between 2006 and 2010 when you're talking about immigration and lots of other things, and that's the economy. If we were down in 4.5% unemployment land 4 years ago, now we're up at 9.5% or almost 10%.
9.9, right.
And that, it seems to me, colors everything. But it does have the lucky effect or salubrious effect with respect to the immigration problem that there's less magnet to pull people over the border to come north for jobs, and that's why fewer people are coming. All indications are that the immigration flow is down from what it was a couple of years ago, and the main reason is the economy.
But you know who is getting a job, or at least been offered a job? Joe Sestak.
Joe Sestak, Pennsylvania, back when the White House and a lot of other people were suggesting he ought to step aside for Arlen Specter rather than stay in the race and beat Arlen Specter, which of course we know he did. Back then, several months ago, he said, look, a lot of people are trying to pressure me, but I'm the hearty little guy. I'm going to be not a martyr so much as somebody who stands up and shakes a fist at Washington and says, I'm going to run and I'm going to win. And that all worked for him just fine, but people came back and said, Joe, what was that job the White House offered you? And he didn't want to talk about it. And of course, the White House has never wanted to talk about it. Where's this going, Ken?
Well, I don't know. I mean, people are talking about breaking the law, and all seven Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee this week sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder asking for a special prosecutor. Now, of course, that is a lot of politics and maybe just politics, but
they what exactly would be the crime?
According to this excerpt here from Jake Tapper of ABC News, here's what he wrote. The job offered to Sestak would appear to violate federal criminal laws, including 18 U.S.C. 600, which prohibits promising a government position, quote, as consideration, favor, or reward for any political activity, or, quote, in connection with any primary election or political convention or caucus held to select candidates for any political office. Now, that's what's in U.S. Code 600. Of course, the point is, it's done all the time.
Has this ever been prosecuted?
No, and everybody agrees this is politics as usual. The difference is, and this, here it comes to the politics and less legality, is that President Obama promised more. He promised transparency. He promised we would not do what is constantly being done in Washington. And to watch Robert Gibbs, both on the Sunday talk shows and in press conferences all week, say, I am not going to address this. Whatever we did is fine, but I'm not going to tell you what we did. And he said that over and over again. And David Axelrod said the same thing over the weekend. He says, look, we didn't break any laws, and that's as far as I'll go.
Now, that makes it sound like the real problem here is a communications problem, that the way the White House handled problems, maybe it's this one, maybe it's the Gulf oil spill, maybe it's the departure of Admiral Dennis Blair as the Director of National Intelligence, which happened since our last podcast. All of those things may not have necessarily had to have been big negatives for the White House, except for the way that it was handled.
Perception is reality, especially in Washington and especially on this podcast.
Speaking of really bad communications, but also possibly speaking of getting away with it, what's going on in Connecticut? I just saw a poll this morning that showed Richard Blumenthal still ahead of Linda McMahon by more than 20 percentage points after the blow he took for what he said about his Vietnam service. Ken, how can that be possible?
Well, on Talk of the Nation this week, John Dankowski, news director, I guess, of WNPR, said that the perception between people in Washington and people in Connecticut is tremendously different. Dick Blumenthal always had an exemplary record, very popular state attorney general for 20 years. The kerfuffle over what he said, he apparently dealt with it. It took him a while to apologize. But there's also the fact that he's running against Linda McMahon. Linda McMahon, who became the Republican nominee over the weekend. Rob Simmons, a former congressman, Vietnam War veteran with two bronze stars.
I mean, three tours in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And yet, this is the part that really, really surprises me. Okay, maybe Linda McMahon is not the greatest messenger for the Republican Party in Connecticut, but they had Rob Simmons. Here's a guy who did three combat tours in Vietnam,
right.
Decorated veteran, served here in Washington, was seen as a moderate congressman, somebody you would think would
have
perfect appeal in a state like Connecticut, and he's rejected by the party at their state convention and then drops out before the primary?
He's not the perfect candidate in 2010 when you're looking for outsiders, when you have Linda McMahon, a candidate.
She's an outsider.
She is an outsider who has already spent $16 million, has threatened or promised to spend it up to $50 million. Rob Simmons was trailing both Blumenthal and McMahon in the polls. And at 67 years old, maybe he just didn't want to go through this. But you would think that with the Blumenthal kerfuffle over Vietnam, and I kind of think it was more than just a slip up. I think
he did it several times.
Yeah,
it's been a pattern.
And I've spoken to a lot of Democrats who were really just unhappy with this. He said, look, you know, it dishonors the people who actually did serve. And to say that it was one videotape where he said in Vietnam, and I meant during Vietnam, it's more than that. It's far more than that. But ultimately, what the voters in Connecticut think is what's important, and they don't think it's a big deal.
I don't think it dishonors the people who have a combat credential. I think it just dishonors the people who try to claim something they have no title to.
But just be, again, just like with Robert Gibbs on Joe Sesak's job offer, just be upfront of what you are and what you did, and that's all voters care about. And obviously, the folks in Connecticut are willing to just give him a pass on this.
Quick last note on this. This is the second time, it seems to me, in just a few weeks, when the primary was supplanted, the system of electing somebody to be the party nominee by primary was supplanted by a party gathering. Same thing happened in Utah, where Robert Bennett was not the choice of a party gathering. And the voters, that is the Republican voters, the people who would vote in the primary, never even got a chance.
And how about the voters in Kentucky who thought they were, didn't realize they were voting on a referendum of the 1964 Civil Rights Act? What is going on in Kentucky and Rand Paul?
This because, as a libertarian kind of Republican, Rand Paul has said that he doesn't think businessmen should be imposed upon by efforts in Washington to impose some kind of morality, whether it's the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990, making people put in wheelchair accessibility and so on, or whether it's even the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So he brought this controversy on himself to some degree, even though he's been trying very hard to take the racial nature out of it by trying to move away from talking about the 1964 Act and saying he would have voted for it.
Well, look, Barry Goldwater, and there are a lot of states' rights conservatives who will say that their opposition to the 64 Civil Rights Act had nothing to do with race. But again, when you're talking about what the 64 Civil Rights Act did and what it accomplished and who benefited from it, obviously, the issue of race, whether Rand Paul is a racist or not, and I'm not suggesting that for one second, the point is it's not something the Republican Party wants to be distracted with, let alone 1964, but certainly not in 2010.
And it gave Mitch McConnell a chance to kind of smile a little bit to himself as if to say, I told you this guy was going to be a problem. You should have voted for my guy, Trey Grayson. But that's all water under the bridge now, and Rand Paul is the standard bearer, and we're going to hear a lot more from him. We also had some results since last we talked with the listener from Hawaii and Idaho. Ken, you're a big Western guy.
Well,
what happened out there?
I'm from the West Bronx, that's true. In Hawaii, first of all, for the first time since 1988, a Republican has been elected to Congress. Charles DeJoo won a special election for the Neil Abercrombie House seat.
Long and distinguished career ahead of Charles as the congressman from Hawaii.
Well, he's probably
until
like...
Until November.
He's probably like Joe Gao of Louisiana, who beat Bill Jefferson. But what the Democrats did is basically their ambition, the ambition of Ed Case and Colleen Hanabusa, the two leading Democrats. Neither one would get out of the race for the other one. And by splitting the Democratic vote...
It was about 60% of the vote was roughly Democratic.
For the Democratic vote.
But they split it.
But this was, of course, the alleged hometown of President Obama. You know, we haven't seen a birth certificate. But we think that he's from Hawaii. And if he is, this is not the kind of seat symbolically that the Democrats would love to lose. Just at the same time, they're nervous about losing President Obama's Senate seat in Illinois, Joe Biden's Senate seat in Delaware, and so you don't want to have that happen as well.
Okay, well, now in Idaho, it was the Republicans who had kind of a surprising result on their side in that primary.
There's a guy named Vaughn Ward, who was an Iraq war veteran, very prominent. The NRCC heralded him as one of the top 10 young guns for 2010. Sarah Palin weighed in with a key endorsement.
Sounds like a blue chip resume.
Except he
lost.
He lost badly, and one of the reasons he lost is because he apparently plagiarized a lot of people, including President Obama. He also, in a debate, he thought Puerto Rico was a country, which was kind of...
Shouldn't make it a state because we shouldn't be out there making other countries into
part of the United States.
States.
And so Walt Minnick, the Democratic freshman, the conservative Democratic freshman, who's been endorsed by the National Tea Party Express, got a little break there. I think Minnick is certainly on the hit list of Republicans, but he couldn't even survive this with a weaker-than-expected Republican challenger.
Not the world's biggest Tuesday coming up next week, but we do have primaries in Alabama, in Mississippi, and in New Mexico. Big headlines there, Ken?
Big headlines. Look in Alabama in the gubernatorial race. Arthur Davis, African-American congressman, of course, would love to be the first black governor of Alabama. There was an African-American third-party candidate in 1970. Nobody since then. But he did vote against the health care bill that folks in his impoverished district in the 7th Congressional District in Alabama felt that was a mistake. And so Arthur Davis is facing a tough primary. He may not survive it. There's also some interesting stuff on the Republican side. Tim James, who had that very controversial ad about English speaking only, and he's also running against Judge Roy Moore, who tried to impose the Ten Commandments on public grounds. So it's a lot of fun going on in Alabama.
A lot of fun in Alabama.
Right. And also Pete Domenici Jr. You're not going to believe this, but he is a son of
Pete Domenici, yeah, former senator from New Mexico.
Right, he's running for governor of New Mexico, but he's an underdog in the race against a likely Democratic candidate.
So some fun to look forward to on Tuesday, June the 1st, and we'll be back next week with all of that information.
Wait, before we go, I know it's time to go, but I just want to say a lot of people were upset about last week's podcast. They couldn't find it. There was a little coding error. I got this note here from Marie Schulte from Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, who says, I need my weekly fix. Where's the May 20th installment of It's All Politics? And on another selfish note, maybe how about a twice-a-week podcast? But anyway, to Marie Schulte, let us be known that we have corrected our errors, and this podcast should be up as usual.
And a big salute and thank you to all our fans in Tosa. That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.